Welcome back to the Big Green Politics Podcast. I'm your co-host Sedan Anlar, and I'm here today with Abhijit Mane, the Deputy Leader of the Green Party of Ontario. Abhijit, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this. You guys are one of my favorite podcasts to listen to, so thanks for having me.
Thank you. Yeah, this interview has been so long in the making, actually. It goes really back because you've supported us and the podcast from the get-go, and that's one of the reasons why I'm really glad I get to do this episode with you. And that's also why I have so many things I want to talk to you about and so many things I want us to cover. Today, basically, I want to get your opinion on the current Canadian political climate, The recent green wave that's been taking over Canada, and of course, the upcoming federal elections. As our listeners may know, the Canadian federal elections are going to be held on the 21st of October. And to be honest, these are really interesting times to be a Green in Canada right now, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's coast to coast.
Exactly. First, I'm actually curious to know a few things about you. Mm-hmm. You're the deputy leader of the Green Party of Ontario.
That's right.
And also, in my opinion, the humble rising star of the Canadian Greens.
Okay, well, don't put words in my mouth.
So I'm curious to know how it all started for you. What was your green awakening?
Right. I've been a part of politics for a while. My grandfather was an MP back in India, and my uncle currently is in provincial politics in India as well. And so it's been a political heritage and a legacy to live up to, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been interested in politics, but never really thought about what that would look like when I myself step into it. My green awakening almost came with food, really, through Michael Pollan. Yeah. So when Michael Pollan, I read The Omnivore's Dilemma, and read a lot of the food movement books by Raj Patel and by Michael Pollan and that movement's greatest writers. And essentially, that's what kind of tipped me over, especially Omnivore's Dilemma, because I became so much more conscious of the way I eat and the fact that, eating, he describes eating as a political act, which is actually a quote from Wendell Berry, who's also a great food writer. Mm-hmm. I think that's such a substantial and big statement, because it's so important to understand that food is the nexus of things like poverty, labor issues, healthcare, social justice, so it can be almost like a hub of different issues to touch on. And food is obviously also a green issue, right? So it's a big, big part of how we even tackle the climate crisis.
And it's one of the things that we do the most.
Yeah, exactly. So it's and it's often not talked about when we talk about climate breakdown and how to institute climate action. So it's one of those things that actually got me started into the green movement, and that was food.
Wow. I was not expecting that one.
Yeah.
But that's why I actually wanted to have a conversation with you about a few different things that have taken place recently in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we'll get deep into other green politics related topics as well. These three incidents, I personally would call them scandals. Mm-hmm. And I believe they've changed the current political landscape in Canada in a crucial way. And one of those things was, we've actually made an episode on this on the podcast, when Julia interviewed Carla Danier, who wrote Europe's first climate emergency declaration, which passed in Bristol back in
UK. Yeah,
fall 2018. And there seems to be a pattern in terms of governments not following up with their own climate emergency declarations. We've seen it happening everywhere, but I think what happened in Canada was an extreme example of that. Also considering you have a Liberal government led by this you know, prime minister known for being a total environment hero.
Right.
Would you like to explain what happened back in June?
Sure, yeah. So to preface it, let's give everyone a little bit of context about what happened before even the climate emergency was declared. And that's actually the fact that the Greens won in Nanaimo-Ladysmith, the by-election, where Paul Manley was elected as the second federal candidate, or sorry, second federal Green MP in the House of Commons in Canada. And so that meant that suddenly the pressure was on the other two parties, the NDP and the Liberals, to also prove their quote-unquote environmental slash green credentials. And suddenly they started, you know, tabling emergency, climate emergency motions in Parliament to so almost compensate for it, right? And to change the narrative around the green wave.
Right. How did that work for them?
Right. So it didn't really work well because it kind of exposed how disingenuous it was, because immediately after declaring the climate emergency, they approved a pipeline for the Liberals and also for the NDP, who are the Social Democratic Party here. They were
literally right after, like a day after.
Yes, exactly. A day after the climate emergency motion, they approved a pipeline. And the irony of it didn't escape Canadians. And also, the Social Democratic Party, the NDP, supported LNG and fracking. So it's almost like greenwashing, essentially, right? You are a failed one too. Yeah. And you're painting yourself as this environmental, party, but, really, you're no better than the climate deniers, because you're not really acting on all these promises that you're making.
Exactly. And what did the Green Party do after that?
So we, you know, Paul Manley and Elizabeth May were finally a two-person caucus in House of Commons now, and they brought in all sorts of different, where they couldn't really table any motions or bills per se, but they enormously expanded their exposure to the Canadian electorate through the interest that was generated by the Green Wave. And it also made sure that the Green Party now was being heard at almost every single avenue. So before, when the Greens, you know, were just considered a quote unquote fringe party, people didn't really give us the same amount of media coverage. But now you see that across the board, Greens are given the same kind of media coverage as the other three status quo parties.
Exactly. So that's how Liberals acted when it came to the climate crisis. I mean, which, to say the least, it's an interesting approach. But what about the other political parties? Because you actually wrote an article on this, which published very recently. It's titled "Choose Wisely: A Comparison of Climate Change Plans of the Federal Parties in Canada." So what about them, and what about their climate change agendas?
Right. So because climate change is becoming such a prominent issue in the Canadian election, it's you know, it's top of mind for many Canadians, especially the younger ones, because it's our future. It's fast becoming the top issue, if it's not there already. Housing affordability and other affordability issues are also top of mind, but climate change is up there. And I could even argue that housing affordability is intricately linked to climate change as well, as is other affordability issues, including food. But essentially, what that means is that all the other parties are now playing catch up to the Greens, who have released a comprehensive plan to deal with the climate crisis. And that's a lot of it is modeled after the IPCC report that came out. And our targets are aggressive, but they're necessary. And they're actually also, we also call for a just transition, what Mike Schreiner, the leader of the Ontario Greens, calls a clean and caring economy, to make sure that we're transitioning to the green economy, but at the same time, we're also making sure that we build a bridge between the new and the old, and make sure that everyone crosses over and no one gets left behind.
Right. So we just talked about what happened after the Parliament declaring a climate emergency declaration, but that wasn't the only thing that happened recently, which I think shaped the pre-elections political landscape in Canada.
Right.
I'm referring to the scandal known as the SNC-Lavalin affair.
Right.
And would you like to explain it, or would you like me to?
Yeah, I mean, either way, you could explain it, and then I could elaborate on it if you'd like.
Sure. Okay. So in 2015, the RCMP, basically Canada's FBI, charged an engineering company called SNC-Lavalin with corruption and fraud for allegedly bribing Libyan officials. And after SNC got caught, they lobbied Trudeau's office to avoid criminal prosecution. And then this February, Trudeau's attorney general testified that Justin Trudeau and his staff pressured her to help SNC avoid criminal prosecution. And because she didn't cooperate, Trudeau, the feminist he is, demoted her, replaced her with a man, and eventually kicked her out of the office. Then in August 2019, Canada's Independent Ethics Commissioner called him out on it and declared that Trudeau and his team had breached ethics rules. And fun fact, Trudeau is the only Canadian prime minister formally found to have broken ethics rules. And of course, he said he took full responsibility but declined to apologize because he was trying to save jobs or something. So,
Yeah, to give you a little brief about why that was, I mean, a big part of it is also because SNC-Lavalin is a massive institution in Quebec, right? Which is the French-speaking or the majority French-speaking province in Canada. And Trudeau is also an MP from Quebec. And a big path to liberal majority government, as they had, you know, almost like planned for, I guess, in 2019, led through getting as many seats as possible in Quebec.
Right.
So because SNC-Lavalin, if they lost all those jobs, would mean that Quebec would be, you know, angry at the Liberals and not get them as many seats. So it's a lot of it is also just nitty gritty political electoral stuff as well. And when the Attorney General, Ms. Wilson-Raybould, spoke up against it, they essentially just demoted her first, as you said, and then they kicked her out of cabinet. And now she sits as an independent and is running as an independent and might even get reelected as an independent, which would be very exciting.
Wow.
Yeah, so she was also mulling for a while about joining the Greens, but decided to run as an independent. And, you know, I think it's important to have some independent MPs in Parliament so that they can, you know, voice that independent voice rather than having party aligns, which is, I mean, one of the reasons why I joined the Greens as well is the fact that I like that they don't whip their votes, because that means that we MPs and MLAs can essentially vote for what their constituents want rather than, you know, what the party wants.
Exactly. But is this the level of corruption in Canada right now? And do you think people see it through now?
I think a lot of it is, you know, like, because of the hyper-partisanship of the nature of politics here, especially, you know, a lot of the Liberal supporters are just not ready to understand just the degree of corruption that's involved. I mean, to, you know, intimidate and to pester the Attorney General and essentially into interfering in a legal matter is a grave violation of our governmental relations. And so it's quite disconcerting when that happened. And also, what else is disconcerting is the fact that the Liberals were able to bounce back from that, because you know, people kind of forgot about it after a while. It was this massive thing in around March and February, but now, you know, closer to June and July and August, it was almost a no issue by that time. So
exactly. People consume news in such a pace now.
Exactly.
Even right before the elections. But it kind of feels like he's trying to enter the next election as like an underdog.
Right.
Scandal after scandal. And his approval ratings really show that because it's been plummeting for the past year or so, especially over the past few months.
Right. And I'm sure what's happened in the past few days are going to be helpful for the prime minister's approval ratings, as I'm sure the viewers know about the other scandal involving all the brownface / blackface photos from the prime minister's past.
Exactly. I mean, I was on social media when I saw it, and I had this interview in mind, of course, this episode, and I was like, what can I ask?
Right. Yeah.
And what can I say?
I remember watching it and being just completely taken by surprise, right? Like so by the way, full disclosure, before I joined the Greens, I used to be with the Liberals. And mm-hmm. so I still
so
have
this was
soft
even
spot.
More.
Yeah,
shocking.
Exactly. I have a soft spot for the Liberals, but mm-hmm. at the same time, I also have, you know, a really good reason for why I left. And this just kind of built on it. It almost felt like a betrayal, right? Because here's this person who considers himself a champion of progressive causes, of whose father was the harbinger of, the Canadian multicultural identity. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it definitely hurts. I did think that his apology was sincere, and I do accept it as such, but it still was very hurtful. And it took a while to process it all. Even the vitriol and the whataboutisms on social media, the partisan hackery going at each other afterwards that morning was just an incredibly gross experience. And so I had to collect my thoughts a little bit, and I did make a post later on social media about it, but it was,
which I liked.
Yes, thank you. I didn't notice that. Thank you so much. It was just a weird cocktail of emotions and feelings.
That's a very good way of putting it. Well, I was also shocked by how media reacted and handled it, because he was given his first apology speech right afterwards. And the first two of the first three questions were, what do you think about the timing?
Right.
How is that the first question?
Yeah, exactly.
You could ask so many questions. And of course, it wasn't a person of color asking that question. All know that.
That's right. There was not a single journalist on that plane press conference who was a person of color. That was
mind-boggling.
That was another thing that kind of was, just another layer to this whole thing. And Fatima Syed, I believe, of the another racialized, she's a reporter who's a person of color. She pointed that out, and she, also had a few questions about, like, when did you confront yourself, or did you confront yourself about this? I think that was very poignant, because if there was a person there who may have had an experience that was, hurtful, and that was maybe even triggered by that photo, maybe the questions would have been different.
Exactly. And I think it's so unfortunate, but I think it presented an opportunity for the voters to see how he, because it says a lot about someone's personality.
Agreed.
What they've done and how now they can, or whether or not they take responsibility for it.
Right.
And I also thought maybe finally, this will give us the opportunity to have a more of a mainstream conversation about the institutional and systematic racism in Canada. And the fact that it's not just a binary thing. It's not like someone is racist or not.
Right.
We all are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there was a fantastic Twitter post, which is now also an article, I think, in the Taii, which is a publication out west, by Rithika Goel. And she talks about, about that exact thing, that racism is not a binary. You're either racist or not racist. You know, all of us live in institutions and societies that are systemically racist. And mm-hmm. so we are all a product of that, and we harbor a little bit of racism in ourselves, and it is a spectrum. And so we need to confront that and understand that in order to have a conversation about it, we can't bury it under the carpet by, you know, labeling people as these, yeah, binary terms, essentially.
Exactly. And to be honest, it wasn't much of a shock to me because, I mean, he is a straight, able-bodied white male. Mm-hmm. And in his political career, he did support Trump's coup in Venezuela. He did support Israeli occupation in Palestine and the US-Saudi-led attacks on Yemen and mm-hmm. the pipeline expansion, where there's a huge indigenous people's community. Mm-hmm. So I personally wasn't really shocked to see he did some racist things in his life, yeah, because that's kind of how this works. Yeah. And that goes for everyone. And, you know, we all grew up in this world and we've been taught and conditioned to mm-hmm. think in this way. And that goes for leftists. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that leftist white guy who read like 3 books about other continents that are oppressed groups and now thinks he knows all about how racism works. Mm-hmm. That's not how it works. We do the work too. People of color feel like they need to decolonize their minds and
right.
constantly deconstruct everything that's been taught to us. So you need to do the work too.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, and you raised some great points. And to Prime Minister Trudeau's credit, he did concede the fact that, you know, he's wrapped in an incredible amount of privilege because of his upbringing and his essentially blinders that the privilege has put on him. So to his mm-hmm. credit, he did concede that, and I'm glad that he did, because it's important for people to see the Prime Minister do that.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, you know, especially the issue of Canada to Indigenous relationships. I mean, mm-hmm. the relationship in itself is, you know, kind of the crux of it is this horrific racist document called the Indian Act, and mm-hmm. which is, you know, still the foundation of a lot of these relationships. And until that itself is examined and changed, really, there's going to be a systemic racism within Canada Indigenous relationships to come. So it's something that even, yeah, Elizabeth May has talked about, is the fact that we need to get at the, you know, at the very foundation of this issue, and that is the Indian Act.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an amazing point. Before the interview, I was also trying to track where the photos have come from or mm-hmm. these videos. And turns out it was the US media.
That's
and
right.
And then I thought about the other embarrassing stories for Justin Trudeau that mm-hmm. came out recently or just this year. And I kind of tried to track them down as well, and all US media.
Yep.
And I was thinking, it's hard to believe that the Canadian media didn't have these black and brown face photos and videos, because he is the son of a previous prime minister mm-hmm. and was an MP for 10 years, a prime minister for 4 years. I can't believe that they didn't track these photos down from right. his previous workplace. So I think we also need to have a conversation about why the Canadian media couldn't get themselves to go ahead and expose and reveal these photos.
Yeah, no, it's a great point that you brought up. I mean, you know, I'm sure it could be entirely possible that, and it could be true, that the argument that the Liberal supporters are making is that, you know, this is American intervention in Canadian politics.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be true, but it's also maybe an independent media that is, you know, independent from the political scene of Canada, making these forays. To be completely honest, I hadn't even considered this viewpoint up until the moment you just said it. And I think it's an important one to look at, because, yeah, that means that, you know, I'm still kind of new to politics, right? Like I'm still navigating this field, but a lot of it in, especially mm-hmm. in Canada, is based on goodwill between, say, media and politicians, or media both ways, mm-hmm. and it goes, right? So it, I'm sure if media want access to politicians, they don't want to cause massive political scandals for them.
Exactly.
And that's something that maybe, yeah, it definitely needs to be examined.
Yeah. And the issue of lack of diversity that we just talked about, maybe yeah. that also played a huge role.
Right. And that's it, right? Like, politics, I've come to realize, is a very small group of people who you often see again and again. It's essentially kind of feels like a little bit of an exclusive club, you know?
Yeah.
So I agree, there needs to be a lot more diversity and a lot more inclusiveness of who is in positions of power. Because yeah, often it feels like everyone knows everyone, and like you're like, oh wow, like how do I get in there? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also looking at these three individual incidents. Mm-hmm. I think the media, the mass and mainstream media, is called the last two, the SNC mm-hmm. and the brown and black face photos and videos scandals. Mm-hmm. Great. I agree. Mm-hmm. But not really the first one, not really the climate emergency declaration. And after just a day later, right. the parliament declaring approving a pipeline extension.
Right.
They didn't call that a scandal, which could be telling, you know,
of the priorities.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's again, good point, because it's quite telling of how the narrative is. To Canadian media's credit, again, it's happening now. I mean, it's a little too late, but at least yeah. it's happening. That, you know, CBC now has a special page just for climate news.
Mm-hmm.
In the UK, The Guardian came out with a dictionary of terms to use, right, when addressing climate issues. So at least the media landscape is changing now, but it's still too slow and the priorities are still too skewed.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of that also has to do with corporate ownership, right? And
absolutely.
What is dictating those priorities within the media.
Exactly. And some of that progress is thanks to the mobilization around climate change and the climate mm-hmm. crisis. Just like, I mean, we're recording this episode on the 20th of September when
that's right.
the youth takes the streets, or to take over the streets.
A great selection of date, by the way.
Was not intentional, but I'll take yeah. that. Thank you. And considering all the mobilization around the climate crisis,
mm-hmm.
is this election about the classic battle between the different economic models of liberals and conservatives, or are there other dynamics involved this time that make this election different and special? What do you think?
Right. Yeah, I think there's definitely something different about this election. It feels different. Even the polling dynamics, and if you look at, you know, all the pundits that you see on TV,
mm-hmm.
Even they're talking about it. The fact that the Greens are surging and they're, you know, ahead of the NDP, which is again the Social Democratic Party here.
Yes.
In some provinces, or some, according to some polls federally, we're ahead of them
mm-hmm.
in third place. So it's a very interesting dynamic, because, and that's, I think, one of the reasons, the Green Wave is one of the reasons that the Green Party has adopted its slogan, which is not left, not right, but forward together. Mm-hmm. Because we can't play to those old left-right political paradigms anymore. And I think it's more important to mobilize our society as a whole. And that's why we've advocated for things like establishing a war cabinet of mm-hmm. all parties, because we can't afford to be a fractured society at this moment, and need to be a concerted effort to mass mobilization of a society towards a clean and caring economy.
Exactly. And just to put it very simply, people are tired of it too. Like, people are sick of it. All this like scandals and the classic conflict between the liberals and the conservatives. And this is very, this has been pretty evident, looking at how the recent elections have gone in Canada, all the recent Green Wave.
Mm-hmm.
Ontario.
Right.
Mike Schreiner, last June. And then there were huge wins and gains in
New Brunswick. That's right.
Yeah.
So we tripled our seats from 1 to 3.
Exactly. Prince Edward Island.
Right. That was the big story where we basically went from 1 seat 4 years ago to 2 seats 2 years ago with the by-election of Hannah Bell. And then now they're the official opposition there with 8 seats.
Exactly. And you mentioned also Paul Manley getting into the parliament as the second Green candidate elected to a federal seat.
That's right.
And I think the Greens have held the balance of power in British Columbia for 2 years now.
That's right. And people, you know, had predicted that that relationship would never fail. They didn't enter into a formal coalition. What they did was they entered into an agreement of supporting the government from outside.
Mm-hmm.
And that has worked. That has worked well, and you know, that's one of the reasons why the Greens, being the balance of responsibility, the balance of power in British Columbia, is the reason that the Trans Mountain pipeline isn't passing through British Columbia. It's the Greens that are holding it in check by making sure that the NDP government there doesn't approve it.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Apart from the mobilization around the climate crisis, why do you think Canada has been experiencing this green wave? What has changed and why now?
Well, I mean, I think the most obvious reason is the immediate effects of climate breakdown that we're noticing. The rampant floods, the storms, the droughts, the forest fires, all of it is right there staring Canadians in the face. And I think Canadians are recognizing that this is something that we need to tackle in order to, you know, continue our way of life. Insurance companies are another ally in this because they're recognizing the fact that, you know, these premiums are going to go up, and climate change essentially is going to make their business model moot.
Wow.
And, so the fact that corporations...
That's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, exactly. The fact that corporations are getting on board is evidence of the fact of how serious the issue is. And finally now there's some political inertia that was there is now being, you know, obliterated. And the fact that what was considered a small party is now rising to the fore is very disconcerting for all the status quo parties.
Yeah. So we're talking about the recent green wave in Canada. We both listed a few, you know, recent green wins and gains.
Mm-hmm.
They're mostly local elections and victories achieved on a local level.
Right. And yeah, we forgot to mention quite a few Greens also got elected on the municipal level as well.
Mm-hmm.
In Ontario, there's no parties associated on the municipal level, but a lot of the Green Party candidates who ran for city council are now elected in places like Kingston, Barrie, down south near Belleville, and across the country as well, many in British Columbia as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting because local politics has always been important for Greens, for Green parties around the world. And that could be because the Greens do face certain challenges on a federal level. It could be because of the system. When there is a local green wave, when that is the case in other countries, we usually don't see the same level of success being achieved at the federal level.
Right.
And why do you think that is? Or what do you think the Greens' challenges are on a federal level?
Right. I think a lot of the challenges are similar, especially for the federal Greens, as they are for the Ontario Greens, or even, say, for the Manitoba Greens, for example. Mm-hmm. So in British Columbia and PEI, the political landscape is such that only 3 parties are essentially vying for seats, right? In British Columbia, it's the Liberals, NDP, and Greens, whereas in PEI, it's the Liberals, Conservatives, and Greens.
Yeah.
So in PEI in British Columbia, the Greens are a third party, whereas in Ontario, we're the fourth party, where Conservatives, Liberals, and NDP are also competitive. So it's a much more crowded field. And the similar landscape exists federally with even more players with like the Bloc Québécois and now the People's Party. So it's a much more crowded field, essentially, is one of the biggest challenges for federal Greens compared to the provincial cousins. And another one also is obviously the first past the post, right? But that's a challenge across the board. The fact that Greens have been elected to at the rates that they are in Canada, despite first past the post, is just nothing short of a miracle, because it's such a unfair system and it's so unfairly stacked against the smaller parties. And one of the reasons why the Greens in Europe are doing well was because of proportional representation.
Yeah.
And except for, obviously, Britain, right?
The UK.
You guys still have, you guys still have first past the post. And it's incredibly undemocratic when you have parties that have, for the longest time, Elizabeth was just a single Green MP, even though we were polling at around 5-6%. With a representation, that number would have been much higher.
I mean, the bar is set incredibly high in Canada. Yeah,
exactly. And that's it too, right? Like, and then it leads to all sorts of just frustrating conversations around things like strategic voting, right? I don't want to split up the progressive vote. I have to vote, you know, either Liberal or NDP. And it's like, do you though? Like, it, do you understand how insane that is? Because that means that you think one of those parties are entitled to people's votes, firstly. And secondly, the fact that people are not voting for what they want, but against what they don't want, is such a pessimistic and jaded way of looking at politics.
Exactly.
And it definitely does not inspire people to go out and vote. And that's also one of the reasons why we have such low voter turnout.
Exactly. And then also the Green Party then has to go out and persuade voters that, first of all, their party will best serve Canadians. Okay. But then they also have to persuade them and say, look, enough other Canadians share the same set of preferences. They will vote for us as well.
That's right.
That's just a lot of work.
We have to show our electability, as it's called, right? Like, it's incredibly frustrating because it's a conversation that would never happen with proportional representation, right? In that case, it would be whoever has the best platform. Okay, I'm gonna vote for that person.
Yeah.
And then, you know, based on what kind of electoral system it is, it'll be either mixed member or, you know, proportional. So it would be such a different political landscape, and we'd be able to deal with issues like climate change so much more profoundly, because first past the post is an antiquated system, and that's why it's causing a political logjam, because it's not designed to deal with the problems of this century.
Exactly. I mean, the goal is for the popular vote to translate into actual representation in the parliament. And I think what you said about the frustration from Prince Edward Island, the provincial party leader, Peter Bavin-Baker, he said, I'm just going to quote him because he put it in a great way. He said, it took decades to build this credibility among Islanders and to reach a point where they felt comfortable voting Green. The Greens still have to prove that they're credible, while other parties get exposed for different scandals day after day. It's just, like, I just don't understand.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, it's not the same, but it's similar to, like, women or people of color having to work much more in the workplace just so they can prove themselves.
That's right.
There is no logical reason, but that's just the reality. We all know it.
That's right.
And I understand when people say, oh, yeah, the Greens are just outsiders, and that's why it takes them a long time to trust the Greens and much more efforts from the Green side to put into. But I just don't understand how people feel safer to vote and give power to the evidently, clearly corrupt politicians. But it just doesn't feel safe to vote for people that have gotten like arrested for protesting to protect the environment.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I think you phrased it a great point. Peter, just for the listeners and, you know, just for the record, ran 10 times before, after which he was elected. That's crazy that that wonderful man had to run 10 times before he was finally elected. And
that's why he said that. Now I understand.
Yeah, yeah. But Prince had, but the Mau Islanders like adore him, you know, and his popularity ratings are still the highest amongst Islanders. So that definitely proves the point that you were trying to make. I think if you look at it in almost like through a marketing lens, if you will, it kind of makes, kind of starts to make sense. It's still frustrating and annoying, but kind of starts to make sense in the fact that it's about the brand, right? The brand of the Conservatives and the Liberals is just longer, and even to the NDP to an extent, just because of the longevity and the duration of its existence. The fact that these two parties, the Conservatives and the Libs, have been in existence since Confederation, they have this massive reputation and a sense of stability associated with them that they have built their brand over time. Obviously, if you notice, like, you know, Liberals sometimes and even Conservatives get decimated in elections, but they bounce back from them. Because of that brand and has staying power. Whereas the Greens, you know, who have been around only for a few decades or so, don't quite have that yet. But the problem is we don't have time to execute the plans that we need to have in place. And so it's a very big concern that, that, you know, these parties that have the established narrative, have the understanding of Canadians of, you know, what they represent. Canadians understand, okay, these are Liberals. This is what they stand for. These are Conservatives. This is what they stand for. These are the NDP. This is what they stand for. But you Greens, what are you? Just the environmental party? So it's a bit of...
Get out of the room.
Yeah. So it's a bit of the, you know, like, it's a bit of the messaging itself. And that's one of the things that we struggle with too. You know, when people just clump us as an environmental party, it's, well, have you read our platform? Have you seen it? Have you seen how comprehensive it is? I think it's slowly changing now, actually. I'm seeing a lot more people understanding the fact that, no, it's not just an environmental party. It's a massive, comprehensive platform that addresses.
And everything is linked.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, Elizabeth also put this well that, you know, we are not a one issue party, but if we had to be, I mean, an environment is a good one issue to have because everything is in the environment, including healthcare, including the economy. And so
us too.
Us, exactly. So it's very confusing when people say that you're just the environmental party, because it's like, okay, but you're a part of the environment too.
This bias is an interesting one to deconstruct, because it's kind of a never-ending circle or cycle, because the first past the post system is kind of like a symptom, but also the cause of this bias against the Greens. So it just never ends.
Yeah,
but also I think the Canadians have an interesting relationship with the first past the post system. They've been presented the opportunity to vote against it. And like British Columbia had a referendum on proportional representation in 2005 and 18, and it got defeated both times. And then the same result came from Ontario in 2007, and then Prince Edward Island received the same results in 2005, 16, 19. So what's going on? Is there a really good counter campaign? Are no big parties for it?
Yeah, so I think it's all of that that you just mentioned. it's the fact that the first pass, the side that's for not changing the status quo just has a lot more money. And so a lot more resources are being funneled into those campaigns, and the counter and the PR camp, like the proportional representation campaigns, just don't have those kind of resources to match. Secondly, yeah, the big parties don't want it. I mean, one of the greatest betrayals of Prime Minister Trudeau was when in 2015 he campaigned multiple times on instituting first past the post and then immediately getting into power. You know, he went back on it completely. And it was, I think that was one of the greatest betrayals. And that was one of the reasons I left the Liberals to join the Greens. And then the other thing also is the fact that the way that the proposal was brought forward was a little confusing, because when you bring these multiple proportional representation systems to the people, you kind of start, you know, giving them like, oh, this is MMP and this is this. So like it starts becoming like a veritable, you know, like buffet of electoral reform propositions. And people are like, oh my God, I don't know what to choose. So I'll just stick to what, you know, I know.
Of course, like, of course.
It's all kind of like if you go to a restaurant, you know, you order the usual rather than experimenting. It's definitely a combination of all those things that we talked about.
Yeah. And I mean, it's one of the fundamentals of the Green Party, because it's so important for them. I'm sure this is like the center of, you know, going forward with their agenda.
Yeah.
So Justin Trudeau promised that the 2019 federal elections wouldn't be held under the first past the post system, but it seems like that's going to be the case. It is going to be held under that system. So what are your predictions? What do you hope to see happening?
Well, as of, you know, 2 days ago, it seemed like there was a certain trend happening. Now I don't know. Like, I don't know if the whole scandal is going to affect, the Liberal Party's numbers in any way. Maybe minor changes, but it seems like they might hold steady. So what I'm hoping for is a Liberal minority government with the Greens holding them responsible in a, you know, balance of responsibility type of situation, similar to BC. That would be ideal. And so currently, as it stands, the Liberals and Conservatives are statistically tied, but the Liberals have more seats predicted to be won. So there's obviously the case of, you know, if what happens if the Conservatives win. Well, Elizabeth has said that we will support any party that has a good climate plan. And currently, as it stands, doesn't look like the Conservatives have any sort of substantial climate plan. Yeah. They call it a real plan, and it has like nothing. As you mentioned earlier in my article, the only thing that the Conservatives had that I mentioned was a procedure to build electric charger station infrastructure. And it was, you know, everything else is like about garbage cleanup and things of that nature. And it's
all the fundamentals,
Yeah, exactly. So there's no price on pollution. There's no,
they really get it, Abhijit.
Yeah, they totally do. But you know, it's obviously the Greens are not going to be supporting the Conservative government, if their climate plan is as they're presented. So it looks like it could even lead to a hung parliament, you know. Hopefully it is. I mean, it looks like it's probably going to be a Liberal minority government with the Greens holding the balance of responsibility.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how especially the last scandal is going to affect, or whether or not it's going to affect, because I mean, right now, Justin Trudeau's approval ratings are below Trump's approval ratings.
That's right.
Although this probably says more about the U.S. society and the than it does about the about Justin Trudeau or the Canadian society. But of course, we need to mention, if we're, you know, talking about the approval ratings, the one and only leader that's running in this election that has a with a net
positive,
yes, exactly, approval rating, Elizabeth May.
That's right. Elizabeth, you know, she's proven time and again how resilient she is, how powerful she is. She's like a workhorse, you know. She is one she's been voted as the hardest working MP in the House of Commons time and again by her colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And she embodies that completely. She's intelligent. She's brilliant. She's empathetic. She is very knowledgeable about almost everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, like, we're realistic and we know that we're not going to form government this election, but I think she would be the best prime minister amongst any one of the federal leaders, because she has it all. And, you know, she also has a great amount of integrity and honesty that she mm-hmm. brings. And it was reflected in the federal leaders debate that happened, a few days ago. And, you know, like, hands down, everyone, said that she just swept the field because she just showed the rest of them how, you know, leaders actually, debate and act.
And her approval ratings, like, it's amazing.
And has stayed that way constantly.
Exactly.
You know, they have always been that high, but now her party's approval ratings are also coming to meet her.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that is in spite of this bias that we talked about and the first past the post system. That's,
right.
I mean, imagine if these hurdles weren't there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, exactly. Right. Like, we know under first past the post, the Greens are polling at a certain level because mm-hmm. of strategic voting. Imagine what happens when the full potential of the party is unleashed and people start to vote for what they actually like, and they're saying, oh my god, these Greens are actually doing fantastic work. As you can see in PEI, you know, they, even though they're the official opposition, they have made sure that the government processes are much more efficiently run now. Even heckling has stopped in the legislature. I mean, imagine that, you know, no heckling in your parliament. Whenever I go to Queen's Park, it's so embarrassing for me when I sit in the gallery and I see the Conservatives and the NDP going at each other. You know, mm-hmm. it's the school kids are visiting from, you know, different schools across Ontario, and it's just absolutely embarrassing.
Wow, what a scene for them to see.
I know. So inspiring. It's a very embarrassing moment whenever kids visit the chamber, and that's, you know, that's a very bleak commentary on Ontario politics.
Yeah. And you said, imagine what if, you know, the Greens
case in PEI. That's right. And they've also reformed the committee process so that now even committees are much more efficient and they can actually get a lot more work done and a lot more legislation passed. So it's, you know, whenever Greens get into legislature, it changed the tone of the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also just becomes a much more productive and efficient body that works for people.
Exactly. I actually do want to imagine. So let's say, no first past the post system, Elizabeth May, same approval ratings, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. Come the 22nd of October, the Greens are in power in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What will that Canada look like?
I think that would be a Canada that will be ready for dealing with the climate change. That will be ready to lead the world in the climate action revolution. That'll be ready to take its place back in the world order where it once was a respected member of the world community for its genuine action on the issues that it cared about, on the genuine action of the values that we embody. And that's exactly what the Greens will bring when we form government, because it's all the things that are mentioned in Mission Possible, that's forming the war cabinet, making sure that we transition to the clean economy, making sure that we take care of our most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all very much Canadian values of cooperation and, you know, social community. So mm-hmm. the Green Party, you know, is obviously, we have global values, but we also make sure that we also reflect our own country's values as well. And that's definitely the case with the Canadian Greens. And they definitely deserve a place at the House of Commons, but mm-hmm. I think they would make a fantastic government when that time comes. Not if, but when.
Well, on that note, Abhijit, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sedan,
for coming on to the podcast. I really enjoyed our conversation, and do come back.
I would love to. Thank you so much. And yeah, thanks for doing this. Love to come back.
Thank you.
Cheers.
All right, folks, that's our show. You can follow us and show us some love on Twitter at Big Green Pulp Pod. You can find us on any podcast apps, iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud.
And if you want to help us make green politics more accessible, subscribe and support us by leaving us a rating or a review. Thank you so much, and see you soon.